This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
When we last spoke to Michael Gray, we talked about Street Legal from his work in the first chapter of Song and Dance Man, Volume 2, where he makes the compelling argument that the signs of Bob Dylan heading towards Christianity are laced throughout Street Legal. Today, we talk about that arrival, which, as we all know, formally took place with the 1979 release of Slow Train Coming and continued most directly through 1980's Saved and 1981's Shot of Love. Gray covers Bob's Born Again period in Song and Dance Man, not with a detailed tour of the three albums that are generally considered to represent it, but with deep looks at several songs from that period. Today we'll discuss two of them with Michael: an outtake called Yonder Comes Sin and the widely loved Every Grain of Sand. Throughout our discussions on the chapters from Song and Dance Man Volume 1, Michael showed us how Dylan's lyrics referenced or were influenced by his deep knowledge of folk, rock, literature, and then the blues. In song after song, we learned how lines and images that seemed like just interesting things Dylan had written were in fact part of something larger, connected to things that came before and things that made them potentially mean something beyond or different than what we may have known or thought. The Bible was not left out of those discussions, but in this period, it is the Bible that is most directly fueling Dylan's songwriting, and for many of us, those references are even less familiar, which makes the tour Michael Gray takes us on in these chapters even more valuable. For however much Bible you thought was in these songs, there is more, way more. The discussions you're about to hear about Yonder Comes Sin and Every Grain of Sand are perhaps my favorite so far, because of how much these chapters reveal about these songs. The nature of Michael's work and writing is such that, if time permitted, I would discuss nearly every paragraph. It's very tough to choose the quotes we use in these episodes and to narrow down the discussion. So for this episode more than most, I want to explicitly say how highly I recommend that you get the book and read the full chapters. We have a very special reader for this episode, and that is Michael Gray himself. You'll hear music interludes before and after the readings, as they're not always introduced in the commentary. Now here's my discussion with Michael Gray. Hi, Michael. Welcome back.
Hi.
We are in book two. We're going to look at chapter two to begin. And last time we talked about Street Legal, which, as you showed us all, was full of signs of where Dylan was about to head. And now we arrive squarely in the gospel years.
Yeah.
You've chosen, however, to not take an album approach to these couple of albums, but you picked a few songs and really look at them and give us still a very good sense of what Dylan was doing and why. For the first, you again made the bold choice you did in one of the book one examples of picking an unreleased song, which, as I was thinking about over the last few days, must have been extremely frustrating for people when these things were really hard to find. So the song is Yonder Comes Sin, which thankfully now most people are familiar with, because it's like on the bootleg series, and it's broadly available, I'm sure, on YouTube, and we can put some links in.
Yeah.
But of all the material put out in the, you know, Shot of Love, Save period, and we're going to get to some more in a minute, why was it so representative that you thought it could kind of hold the space of gospel in your discussions of what Dylan did?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, you referred to the unreleased song that I mentioned that I picked out in volume one, and that was Lay Down Your Weary Tune. I could just say it's a very long time ago when I chose these things. And so, you know, why should I remember why I honed in on these things decades ago? But I would say this, that in each case, the song seemed so striking and so unlike anything else he was recording at the time that it compelled attention, from me at least. In the case of Yonder Comes Sin, there was such a bluesy, funky recording, and you know, and it snatched away from us towards the end in the version that we ever heard first before it was officially bootlegged. And in that sense, that was tantalizing in itself, and it was a reminder of one of the great outtakes from Blonde on Blonde, "She's Your Lover Now," which collapses towards the end, just after he's sung, "My voice is really warm, but it's just that it ain't got no form. It's just like a dead man's last pistol shot, baby." And there's something of the same strut about Yonder Comes Sin, you know? And as I say in the chapter, it reverberates off a kind of early 60s Elvis Presley single, "You're the Devil in Disguise," as an example of Dylan just beginning to pull away from the certainty of there's only one authority, that's the authority on high. It seemed to me that it was tantalizing. He has one eye on the secular world and its appeals here.
Yeah. As we know, you talk about the time of this recording appeared at a sound check, so he's already on tour. It was a tour that saw the reemergence of the secular material, so that aligns. And, as you say, Dylan starts challenging his own view and position, which brings to mind words that apply to Dylan of nuance and complexity and contradiction. There's a paragraph very, very early in this chapter where you capture this and share what you see as one of the core things that makes the song interesting and important. So let's listen to that, and then we'll talk about it.
This is a specially interesting period. It finds Dylan moving beyond insistence on the tenets of faith toward the pain of recognizing that faith gets tested, that, quote, "sometimes there's someone there, other times it's only me," unquote, and that it's altogether a more complex business than is suggested by "you either got faith or you got unbelief." This shift is first signaled in concert on that November-December 1980 tour on which the current, quote, "religious," unquote, songs are for the first time entwined with songs by others, with the traditional ballad "Mary from the Wild Moor," and with some of Dylan's own earlier work. On record, the same shift away from evangelism is signaled by the LP recorded in the spring of 1981, "Shot of Love," and by the additional material recorded for that album, but unreleased until later. Earliest of all these signals of change was "Yonder Comes Sin," a song that sounds at first thumpingly evangelical, but isn't.
So this is fascinating, of course, because a year earlier, and we've talked a lot in these talks about how quickly time moves for Dylan.
Yes. Right?
So a year earlier, he's a Bible-thumping fundamentalist, no room for the concept of questioning or doubt.
Absolutely. And now he's not with me, he's against me. Yeah.
Right. And which was, right, for all of us, you know, a Bob Dylan who thinks in black and white is not the Bob Dylan we expect. But
indeed, but when we had... he wasn't the Bob Dylan we signed up for, really. he was a Bob Dylan who, you know, shocked us before we could start appreciating the virtues of the music and so on.
You know, I just remembered an interesting thing I saw yesterday that ties into this, because in the Street Legal chapter, you had shown us the signs that maybe the religious period was coming. And I resaw a video of the Dylan parts of the Jimmy Carter movie.
Oh, yes.
And
I saw that recently.
Right. So what's interesting to me is that in 76, 2 years even before Street Legal, Jimmy Carter says that Dylan took him in his courtyard and asked him only about his faith.
Yes. Yeah. So, but that struck me too. I mean, I really liked that program, that whole documentary about the Carter White House. I mean, my God, what a difference in the America of then and now, you know? I mean, it was so open. It was so generous and warm and relaxed. You know, it wasn't just Dylan, it was all those people. But yes, in the when they walk in the garden, Dylan asks Carter about his Christian faith. And that's what he's interested in then, 76.
It all makes sense, obviously, in the real world that Dylan works on things and has learned how to keep them behind and let us know later.
The other thing, of course, in that documentary, it seemed to me was, you know, the way Carter says, Dylan says that when he first met Carter, Carter started quoting his songs to him. And it struck me that, you know, most of us, if we meet Bob Dylan and start quoting his songs, what could be more of a pain in the ass, you know? But somehow there was something about the integrity with which Carter did that, the genuine interest in the material rather than in the charisma of Bob, that really worked. Yeah.
And I'm always amazed at the, you know, clarity, lucidity, whatever you want to call it, of, you know, 80-year-old Dylan sitting there reflecting on this thing 30 years ago, remembering that and calling it up.
Yes.
It's as staggering as anything else he does.
It's you might say, a disappointingly brief interview clip. I wonder how long he actually put up with being asked to speak about him.
You know, there's a lot of those, you know, I mean, some clearly came from, you know, the Jeff Rosen interviews, but some, I think, you know, I saw one of the Baez documentaries where he talked about her separately from the other times.
Oh yeah.
You know, there's a number of these and yeah, you do wonder if they had sort of final cut. And so they taped 20 minutes and Bob said, no, this is the only 30 seconds that does it. Or it's kind of like the way he works with the cameraman in the 2000s when he's on TV all the time and he makes these rules, you know, no cuts. And it's brilliant and, you know, extremely disciplined.
Yeah. I imagine that Ray Padgett will soon interview the cameraman from that session and get the full story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's listen to one more reading where you hone in on this idea of Dylan shifting from black and white to shades of gray.
In Trouble in Mind, the subtext of the song is, God and me, we're okay. In Yonder Comes Sin, the subtext is that evangelizing is all well and good, but that ordinary human life, enjoying old blues songs, flirtation, recollecting pre-conversion good times, present intimacy, that's a valid arena too.
So one of the things that makes, I think, this song great, and I was lucky enough to have it for years and years before it was released and always loved it, and I think you captured in the beginning the idea that it's this fervent, boisterous delivery, which is also impressive to think of at soundcheck, you know, mustering that energy.
Yes.
But like those other songs, and you mentioned them in this chapter, Ain't Gonna Go to Hell for Anyone, there's this preacher like Dylan, you know, yet there's still Dylan humor in it. You know, you can take it on the chin, honey, I gotta run.
Yeah, all those things. And the way that he keeps mentioning Errol Flynn in these religious songs, it's part of his irrepressible buoyancy, I think. His quick mind, that he's not too solemn about it once he snaps out of the preaching. And really, that fervent evangelizing with no sense of humor is a very brief period, we're pleased to see. Yeah. Dylan reaches his final chorus and the end of a song that has proved alive and tough, witty and resourceful, and full of reverberating awareness of life's conflicting positions.
I don't want to go too much further on this song because we're going to get to Every Grain of Sand, which I think is worth the time. But this is a chapter I think people will really enjoy because it takes apart, so to speak, this song in a way that, especially as an outtake, which I don't think most people don't hear as frequently and doesn't get as much attention, I think people really enjoy. And it's a song with a lot of verses, and it covers a lot of ground quickly, and you make a lot of sense of it. And people should go grab this chapter and read it.
Good, thank you.
Chapter 3, we turn to another song, Every Grain of Sand, perhaps the most celebrated Over the Fullness of Time song from the gospel years. I think, you know, everyone loves it. It's just so intrinsically appealing, just the melody and the presentation. And, you know, I admit I was in the camp of, I would have certainly always said I love the song. I was glad when it came on or when he pulled it out in concert. But I realized, having gone through your close reading and explanations, you know, with my own, that it was one of these things where I probably would have had to, you know, hum a few words, and then I could call out a few that I knew. The intricacies are what's there, you know, I really didn't catch. And this exploration of it and explanation of it and contextualizing is really just remarkable.
Thank you.
One of the things that made me think about is Larry Starr was on the podcast in season one. He wrote a book called Listening to Bob Dylan. And one of the things he does, and he's a, I'm going to forget now the kind of music professor he is, but he's a, you know, musicologist at the University of Washington. Uh-huh. But he lists, in the course of the book, he lists 20 or 30 attributes of Dylan that are at play, meaning the song, the tempo, the music, the, you know, this huge list. And it was sort of really interesting, again, to, you know, everyone thinks of all these things, but would have never said, oh, there's all of these. Anyway, it just felt to me like the tone, the voice, that expressiveness in his voice, even if you don't know what he's saying, the harp playing, everything about this song is entirely appealing before you get to what's in it, which is, for me at least, interesting to notice.
Yes, I think it is. I don't mean to sound disparaging in saying that there's a great deal of it that's just on the surface, but, you know, in a way there is, all these things you described, and it's a beautifully constructed song. It's very regular. There are no half rhymes. It has a great deal of discipline in the writing. I mean, Bob says somewhere that he doesn't know where it came from. He just more or less just wrote it down and so on. Well, you know, Bob says a lot of things. And even contrasting that claim with the discipline that the outer layer of the song, if you like, makes clear, is quite surprising. But then, yes, I mean, it's beautiful. And as a melody, as a voice, as a piece of timing, all that works just extraordinarily well, you know. And no one else, for example, could ever deal with something like Cain, I now behold this chain of events that I must break, you know. And he does break on break, but he also pauses enough for anyone to register that chain rhymes with Cain in that thing. I mean, there's just loads of little things that you catch and you pick up on as it flows through when you listen to it. And yeah, you know, you could listen to it a couple of times and just think, well, this is a really nice religious or partially religious song. But maybe, you know, it doesn't necessarily call to most of us to notice how much biblical allusion there is in it. If he had written it in the 19th century, everyone would have picked up on that stuff, anyone literate, because everybody knew their Bible far, far better than we do now. But Bob Dylan His use of biblical text has never been better demonstrated than in this song. You know, all this material about the pool of tears and, you know, Daniel's confession, all these things, the biblical reading that he has done underneath this song is just phenomenal. I mean, I know this because in order to cope with Dylan's born again years, I had to, you know, make myself read the King James Bible from start to finish. I mean, that was part of the work I did, you know, and I can't say it was always enjoyable. It certainly wasn't fun, but there's a lot of beautiful English writing in it and the English language version. But what became so clear was just how much of this stuff Bob Dylan had studied, you know, and how lightly he could bring it in. There's none of the tub thumping here. This is really beautifully crafted biblical allusion.
Yes, and we will get to a lot of that, but I think all of that, meaning the transition from the beautiful surface stuff, if you don't notice, to the idea of what's there is, well, maybe it's the focus of what we're going to talk about now. You begin with an observation that I think most of the light listeners, if we call them that, wouldn't begin to wrestle with, which is questioning whether it's a song of faith or doubt.
Every grain of sand deals very differently from Yonder Comes Sin with what may be conflict just as fundamental, that between faith and doubt. Though, as we shall see, this interpretation of the song's theme seems open to doubt itself. It is when Daniel heeds the prophecies of Jeremiah that he makes his confession. That is, he pours out his soul in fervent prayer to God, earnestly asking for pardon and restoration for his captive people. This is why it is open to doubt as to whether the Dylan song is really about faith versus doubt. As with Daniel, when the song's voice is reaching out somewhere, and when there's someone there only sometimes, it may not be that he doubts God's existence, but that his knowledge of mankind's sins leads him to feel uncertain whether God is yet ready to answer his supplication. On the surface, the bit that comes out to you about doubt versus faith is the quote about sometimes there's someone there, other times it's only me. This must strike most people as a statement that sometimes I wonder if God's there at all. I can't feel him there. He doesn't seem to be there. And, you know, then we get to the end of the verse and we get the neater, more balanced, I am hanging in the balance of the reality of man or of a perfect finished plan, whichever version you're hearing at the time. And either way, balance what? Between faith and doubt? Between understanding and the truth? But yeah, sometimes there's someone there, some other times it's only me is the suggestion of faith versus doubt. But what I'm saying in the paragraph or two that you've just quoted is, in that the text is following Daniel when he's dealing with confession, then, you know, a whole other meaning emerges, which is not faith versus doubt, but faith about whether God is really so forgiving as to still be listening. Sometimes he's there. Sometimes it feels like he's not. Is he sufficiently forgiving? Not just of my sin, but, you know, of mankind's sin in general. I mean, Daniel takes it on himself to shoulder the burden of this whole world. But whether Dylan is imagining himself to be doing that or not. I don't know. But the parallel with Daniel and the narrative voice of Every Grain of Sand is very clear from how many times you can look. In the case in my book, it's there, it's bounced back to you in the footnotes, how many times the text parallels a phrase or a verse of biblical text.
Let me give you an alternate way of hearing the idea of sometimes there's someone there, other times it's only me, which reaches the same conclusion. I took that inverted, meaning I hear something, I turn around. If there's someone there, then they cause the noise. If there's not someone there, but I heard it, that was God. See what I'm getting at? So if it's only me and yet I heard it, that's showing me there's the presence of something else that could be making the noise.
That has never occurred to me.
Yeah, no, that's why I brought it up, because I think, you know, you hear from people these things and they say, no, I always thought this. And you're like, I've heard that a billion times and would have never thought of that. This time it's funny because it's the same conclusion. In my case, when there's not there, it's proving there's God. And when it is there, then it was just some guy kicking the weeds.
Yeah. Okay, yes.
I think you make the point about doubt in a more clear way than I first thought about it, which is it's not about doubt, is there a God? It's about doubt, does God care anymore? Is God or myself acting the way I thought he should? The point I'm trying to make is the song is, it's permeated with a faith, or you wouldn't be wrestling with this. And I don't know enough about faith or wrestling with it to maybe say this, but it strikes me as we're already... What I like about what you've done is it's doubt about subtleties of the existence, relationship with God or whatever, it's not about to become an atheist. He's just questioning the inner process of it.
Yeah, and you know, all the way through that, what it's taking very seriously is the whole question of faith, you know, in a way that most of us don't most of the time. You know, either you go to church and you don't, and so on and so on. But I mean, Dylan is taking this very seriously, almost like an old-fashioned, you know, saint or person who might think of becoming a martyr or sitting on a pole for 20 years or whatever it might be. You know, there's an intensity of engagement with this material, which is most unusual. And, you know, the thing is that at its best, this intensity of engagement with the material, with the biblical text, is fused so beautifully with his intensive engagement with the black church music that he puts with it. Every Grain of Sand is not really an example of that. It's a much more calm and orderly kind of a musical genre. But nevertheless, it's that sort of intensity that in other recordings, he brings in the black church music to accompany Pressing On, or When He Returns, or even Gotta Serve Somebody, which of course is a much simpler statement of belief.
Well, let's start into the song and the text from your book. This is so deep and covers so much ground. We're going to really only talk about a few pages of just a phenomenal chapter. But you know, you mentioned earlier the craftsmanship and the intensity of this. And after this amount of look at it, it seems to me that you know, It's All Right, Ma was a song, you know, that to me, the precision of it, it's more of a list song, maybe in some ways, as you have called them, but you know, there's not a wasted word or a bad, you know, message in it. But the complexity of what's going on here and the precision is on a whole, you know, different level. So anyway, let's listen to a paragraph where you start talking about the first verse, and we can start to unpack this a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. The perplexing pool of tears beneath my feet, in the second line of the song, may be unperplexing if recognized as welling up in the spirit of the psalm supposedly written by Daniel, Psalm 119, the text of verse 136 of which flows naturally on from his confession. Quote, "Rivers of water run down mine eyes, because they keep not thy law," unquote. The fifth line of the song can be understood to take as its text Luke 9:62, in which Christ says that once you are resolved to follow him, you should not delay or go back, even to tell your family you're leaving.
To me, this first paragraph, seeing how you analyze it and forcing me to think much more closely about it, first of all, it shows that there's this incredible layering of the use of language, meaning there's evocative individual words and sort of intricate, strange phrases, right? Newborn seed, morals of despair, which you talk about in the book, which become kind of large, complex ideas in themselves and sort of the clauses. But more often than in most songs, when I was really paying attention to it, they refer back a line or two. It's finishing a thought. Whereas in many of the list songs, for example, right, the get born, get dressed, that one is that one. But yes. In this one, the, you know, the newborn seed is still about the tears, and they cross each other. Then if you know them, potentially the external references start sinking in. And then it turns out that all of this stack is going to a even bigger idea. It's just kind of unbelievable, you know, what's actually there. The pool of tears flooding a newborn seed is a line that I've clearly heard all those words before, but the literal concept of tears being a flood that drown a seed.
Yeah.
It definitely never registered with me. And then as you connect it to Daniel and all this other stuff, it is a seed, right? This song sprouts and there's all this stuff there.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's a great song, and I'm pleased that I had the opportunity to look into it at such length and I hope depth, because, you know, not every Bob Dylan song demands that level of attention. But as I've said at other moments, the use of biblical text in itself is just extraordinary, you know, here. I mean, that referring back that you're talking about, it's paralleled by the way that this works in the Bible, you know, in the way that Psalm 119 is supposedly the psalm written by Daniel. And so when we get to the one bit, we are referring back to the other. And in the same way that the book of Ezekiel is a book about, it's the only book in which doubt is considered in an understanding way, as opposed to merely being condemned. And Ezekiel is the book that Dylan draws upon for example, for This Wheel's on Fire. So, I mean, it's not as if Dylan's use of biblical text has only arrived fully honed in the evangelical period, because it's always been there, hasn't it? It's there in Blowing in the Wind. It's there all over The Times They Are Changing, and so on and so on. It's always been there. And, you know, in that sense, I remember him saying in an interview that he had always read the Bible, but he had regarded it as literature. And then, you know, because of his conversion, he suddenly regarded it as truth, spiritual truth. And, you know, most people, when they're very concerned to thrust their spiritual truth at you, they're rather less complex and thoughtful about it than the Bob Dylan of Every Grain of Sand.
The interesting thing, I think, in this case is, and I've thought about this a lot, as we've gone through the parts of his career we've gone through, and just in this general endeavor of diving in and analyzing his work, is that sometimes understanding those references, it can range from being essentially tedious and not contributing to being fun, to being fun and interesting, to you know, to actually, in this case, I'm not saying it's the only case, but in this case, clearly it becomes more revelatory to the almost to the point of necessary. You know, there's levels of it, but
that's nicely put.
Yeah, I think that was what, you know, did it for me. Like, because I've been listening to a lot more both stuff specifically that you've called out in of blues, and I just watched a great documentary on Chicago blues, which led me to, you know, load my phone with a lot more of all those Chicago blues guys. Uh-huh. And you know, so I'm doing what you did, you know, 50 years ago, and I'm hearing these lines and going, wait a minute, that now I see why, you know, why he says this or that, which is just fun. It's just fun. But the point is, in those situations, and as the mass of Dylan listeners experience them, not knowing doesn't minimize the enjoyment of Dylan's version of it. It's just, there's kind of a little more. Whereas in this case, you sort of, it's almost the opposite, meaning Dylan's references in a song like this, like Cain, I now behold this chain of events that I must break. Well, that's a simple concept you can put in your head if you don't know anything about it, and you can move on. And then in the book, you sort of show that's really related to a very specific and important thing that in itself has context.
Yeah.
Anyway, I hope all this is just encouraging people to really read this chapter and explode this song for themselves.
Well, I hope so. And I would just say to finish that, I hope it justifies the use of the heavy use of footnotes, because I think if you try to put all this stuff into the main text, it would be hopeless. And you know, for the people who hate footnotes, well, they don't need to read them. But I think they're going to miss a lot of what the song contains if they do just skip all the footnotes.
Let's listen to two paragraphs that kind of wrap up this idea.
Those then are the scriptural signposts in the first verse. The second may have as many. Part of the point of the first two lines, in which the wrong sorts of metaphorical flora have choked the breath of conscience and good cheer, is to take up the sustained metaphor in the parable of the sower, told by Christ and recounted by the Apostle Mark. As he sowed, some fell by the wayside, some fell on stony ground, and some fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no fruit. And other fell on good ground and did yield fruit. That's Mark 4:4-8. It may be felt on early hearings that the connection between the lines of Dylan's song and this parallel is tenuous, activated only by Dylan's direct importation of the word choked, or at least that the usefulness of the parable to the song is small. In fact, it goes deeper than that and proves an example of how quietly and intelligently Dylan uses his biblical allusions to speak for him, to articulate his own position.
What I thought might be fun, Michael, because in this case, every line in the song turns into a large set of biblical references and the details in there, and people can read the chapter and spend their time on that. But there are a lot of fun,
interesting
little phrases and clauses that kind of drive the song. I thought maybe we just, the ones that people, if they haven't been going deep, will probably resonate with things they've focused on before, paid attention to. Some of what I'm going to point out really is just things I noticed for the first time that maybe everyone else has known for years. So this is an example of what I was talking about before, about how you have to expand your attention to more than just the last or next three or four words. So the fifth verse, I've gone from rags to riches and the sorrow of the night. And then the fact that all the rest of the paragraph is a list of the places or the examples of that sorrow, you know, a series of bad things. But, and yet, he's gone from rags to riches. So this is how a bunch of bad things created a good result in him. Right? Or rags to riches is a positive transition, and yet it happened through loneliness and broken mirrors and chilly winter and forgotten faces.
Yeah. There's lots of little things like that. That's a good one. And it just reminds me of another, which does get discussed in the book, which is in the chapter, which is how strong the influence of William Blake is, as well as of the Bible. And when I realized it, it was through Dylan's use of a particular word, and the word was wintry, in the chill of a wintry light, not a winter light or a chill light or anything, wintry, which, you know, it's just a very William Blake word. He uses it everywhere in his own work. And it's not a common word. It's not a word that, you know, Rufus Wainwright is going to use, or even Elvis Costello. It's a very literary and specific word. And I loved that. I loved that, yeah.
Good. The next one is I hear my name. I gaze into the doorway of temptation's angry flame, and every time I pass that way, I always hear my name. Well, it had always seemed to me, when I was skipping along the surface, that he's being called to something, and I would have thought that's something good. And this is it's the doorway of temptation, which on closer reading suggests to me it's not a place you want to go. It's an angry flame in the doorway of temptation. None of these are positive things, and that's what's trying to lure him.
Yeah.
So whether it's luring him away from faith, or I don't know what it might be, but it was another juxtaposition I hadn't noticed.
Yeah, it's the doorway of sin and you know, the heat and the flame and the calling.
Oh, here's a little quirky one. I've come to understand, which suggests, like, what's the counter? What didn't he know before? Did it not matter, or was there a level of
Yes, but also you can take that phrase more than one way. I've come to understand in the sense of it has dawned on me to understand, or I have come, I have journeyed, I have traveled to understand.
Oh, that's really different.
So I like that. Yeah.
I have a note here in my a line in my notes that says, understand what exactly?
Yeah. The mysterious ways that God works.
Yeah. So the chapter starts with this really wonderful, and maybe there's one line I want to read, your commentary on the Bootleg Series 1 version.
Oh, about the dog. Yeah.
And the starring role that you give the dog.
Yes.
I think if you would have asked me, I think I would have said he barks once. The fact that he comes back again a second time and is equally well placed, and you even like his timbre, its voice, unlike Dylan's here, has a rounded bell-like tone, harmonically rich and in every way expressive, while the timing of its entrance is startling but immaculate. I come to understand that every hymn is numbered like every grain of sand. That's the best review a dog ever got on record, for sure.
Well, you know, he does seem to me to stand out on that on that demo where Bob's voice is strained. I don't like it. you know, he should have been singing it a key lower, I think. And then a dog comes with this great woof. And as I say in the book, it reminds me of the imitations of the bells on that religious potboiler, Jimmy Brown.
Sometimes I turn to someone there, other times it's only me.
But do you really not enjoy that? This is, I think, an interesting example of where, you know, there have been cases when your level of criticism of things gets called out. And sometimes, and I've been a big defender of it, because as you've said, you know, if there's not greatness, everything's the same. Not only are you looking more closely at more things than many of us do, but, you know, to find an early version, even if Bob is kind of in a hushed tone. Anyway, do you really not enjoy it? Or do you think it's just not in the whole as correct or complete as the later versions?
I just don't like it.
Wow.
I don't enjoy it. I mean, you know, perhaps I should go back and try again.
And then there's the official release, and then we got a version on the Bootleg series, another live version. And the one I didn't give you good fair warning to prep on this, but I know you've commented very positively about the New York 2023, the very recent version in New York. So maybe we'll end with the fact that, you know, this is the closing song that Bob chooses to lay out with great care.